This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The executive director of the NAACP, Ben Chavis, was unable to join us today. We hope to reschedule for sometime next week. A few months ago, a New York Times opinion piece caught our eye, written by Times editorial writer Brent Staples. The piece began with a list of people Staples had been close to who have been murdered. Staples pointed out that most white people who write for a living don't have lists like this. But he said members of the new and tenuous black middle class, like himself, live with a grisly backdrop. Black people, especially black men, are murdered in inordinately high numbers. Staples' new memoir, Parallel Time, begins 10 years ago with the murder of his younger brother, Blake. The two brothers had gone in completely different directions. Brent went to college, got a PhD, worked for the Chicago Sun-Times, then the New York Times. Blake became a cocaine dealer and addict. Parallel Time is about Brent's coming of age in a family that he felt both close to and distant from. Here's a reading from the opening in which Brent is looking at a coroner's photo of his brother's corpse.
This is the body of Blake Melvin Staples, the seventh of my family's 9 children, the third of 4 brothers born 10 years after me. I know his contours well. I bathed and diapered him when he was a baby and studied his features as he grew. Blake was a drug dealer. He was known for carrying guns and for using them. His killer, Mark McGeorge, was a former customer and cocaine addict. At the trial, Mark's lawyer described the shooting as a gunfight in which Blake was beaten to the draw. This was doubtful. Blake was shot 6 times, 3 times in the back. No weapon was found on or near his body. Blake's gun bearer testified that my brother was unarmed when Mark ambushed and gunned him down. But a gun bearer is not a plausible witness. A drug dealer known for shooting a rival in plain public view gets no sympathy from a jury. The jury turned back the prosecution's request for conviction of murder in the first degree. Mark was found guilty of second-degree murder and sentenced to 7 years in jail. 5 years for the murder, 2 years for using the gun. Blake is said to have cried out for his life as he lay on the ground. Please don't shoot me no more. I don't want to die. Please don't shoot me no more. I don't want to die. His voice had a touch of the dullness one hears from the deaf, a result of ear infections he suffered as a child. The ear openings had narrowed to the size of pinholes. He tilted his head woefully from side to side, trying to pour out the pain. His vowels were locked high in his throat behind his nose. This voice kept him a baby to me. This is the voice in which he would have pleaded for his life.
Thanks for reading that, Brent Staples, and that's from Brent Staples' new memoir, Parallel Time. You saw this coming, didn't you? You saw this coming with your brother, that it was possible that he was going to get killed.
Yes, I did. I did. The events leading up to it, young people think they're immortal. He was 22 years old. He was dealing cocaine in Roanoke, Virginia, a town that had become much like any other urban center. And he didn't see that he could be killed, really. You know, I don't think he really thought that he could be killed until that second when he was lying on the ground pleading for his life. A few months, several months before this incident, he wrote a letter to me. I was living then in Chicago, working as a reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times. And in the letter, he recounted to me a fictional version of an incident that had taken place in which he had actually shot someone. But in the letter, he disclaimed doing the shooting. When you have younger brothers and sisters that much younger than you, you know so much about them. You know from their postures and their demeanors what kind of truth they're telling, what kinds of lies they're telling, and also from the sentences they write in letters. And I saw from that letter that, in fact, he had done the shooting and that he was on the run, fearing that he'd be arrested. And I knew from that letter that revenge was on the way.
What did he say in the letter, and what did you read between the lines of that letter?
He said in the letter, well, actually, I think we could read it.
Sure.
Brent, I had to leave Roanoke because things is getting hot there. This boy robbed me over some coke not long ago. They found him in an alley, shot 3 times. The boy is paralyzed from the waist down. I had to get out of town. They think I did it. Brent, Dad won't give me no help or no place to stay. Nobody will. I'm asking you for help, Brent. because if you don't give me no help, one of these banks is going to be my next move. This letter arrived in July of 1982. It was Blake's first letter to me. It would also be his last. The letter was the first notice, my first notice that he was dealing drugs. But also, the letter had a false character to it. He was denying doing something without sort of giving any sort of, it's hard to say exactly what it was. Partly it was the language of the letter. Partly it was knowing him. That I saw right through the lines that, in fact, he had committed this shooting. You know, it was the nature of the denial was so tenuous and so thin.
What did you try to advise your brother to do once you realized that he was dealing drugs and he was also in deep trouble?
I traveled from Chicago to Roanoke, Virginia, to speak with him, and I found him, and I told him quite bluntly. I said, "This is dangerous. You could be killed at any moment. If you don't stop this, you're going to die." That was a very difficult conversation to have with a young man of 22. Extremely difficult. And in the end, after the conversation, I made an appointment to meet him the next day so we could discuss a way for him to leave town. And he said he'd meet me. And of course, I knew at that moment, same thing. I could tell from the, when people say to you, they put you, "Oh, sure, I'll meet you." I knew he wasn't going to meet me. And I guess maybe even subconsciously, I knew that this would be the last time I saw him alive. And it was.
Did you feel that you could have done something else? Or did you feel like his life was in his hands and he was hidden in a direction there was really nothing you could do about it?
When I speak often to high school and sometimes even college students, and they read some essays that were derived from this book, or now they read the excerpt, and they hear about the death of my younger brother. And the younger people often say, "You should have saved him. Were I you, I'd have saved him. There were things you could have done. You could have grabbed him bodily and hauled him out of there." And what I often tell, and what I tell them generally, is that, first of all, you can't treat a man as you might a child. When you attempt to cross that barrier into physical conflict with another adult, no matter whom that adult might be, you're courting disaster. Mm-hmm. And all you can do is talk. And you can talk as persuasively as you can and as long as you can. And at the in the end, if the person can't take some responsibility for themselves or won't take some responsibility for themselves, there's nothing you can do but grieve for them.
Other people in your family tried to do things. Your mother threw him out of the house mm-hmm. when he stopped bathing because mm-hmm. he was getting high on mm-hmm. the drugs he was selling. Your sister, Yvonne, had bailed him out of prison shortly yeah. before he was killed, and then she felt guilty, like maybe she shouldn't have bailed him out. Maybe he would have been alive if she left him in prison. So I guess other people in your family felt that what they tried to do to help him didn't work either.
Family members often, you know, are locked together in these complex, interlocking psychological patterns. And the sense of responsibility for siblings runs very deep, and for brothers and sisters runs very deep. And many, many people in many family contexts, they extend themselves and extend themselves and extend themselves long after it'll do any good, perhaps sometimes long even after they should, you see? And for me, the mechanism was to kind of try to get myself accustomed to the idea of his death long before it happened. And there's no way to say that now without it sounding crass and hard-hearted. But as I say in the book, it was no more thought out than pulling back from fire at the time.
Mm-hmm. You had a really good op-ed piece in the New York Times not too long ago that started with a list of people who you've known who have been murdered. Mm-hmm. I want to ask you to kind of do the beginning of that piece for us to just run through some of the people, family and friends, who you mm-hmm. know who have been killed.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't have a copy with me, but I had a cousin named Paul who was shot to death at the age of 16. There's my brother Blake, who was murdered at the age of 22. There was my boyhood friend Stephen, number 14 on our junior high school football team, who was shot 4 times in the head while selling heroin in Chester, Pennsylvania. There's another Stephen who, in what sounded like a crack-induced rage to me, murdered 3 people and hanged himself in jail. This is the problem of a person of my background. This is the problem of the black middle class, you see. The nascent middle class. Even though I write editorials for the most powerful newspaper in the world, I am connected to another world in which random death and violence, especially having to do with young black men, is quite common.
My guest is Brent Staples. His new memoir is called Parallel Time. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Brent Staples. His new memoir is called Parallel Time. He's an editorial writer with the New York Times. I want to talk a little bit about your childhood.
Mm-hmm.
Your family moved all the time when you were young.
Yes.
What were the reasons why the family was always on the move?
Oh, my family moved because we grew from 1 to 9 children. They moved because we were evicted. We moved because the house fell to pieces around us. You know, we moved for any host of number of reasons. And we went on and on like Bedouins, you know, from one place to another.
And you say your father made a good living as a truck driver, but he drank a lot of
what he made. He did.
So was the family middle class, working class?
Well, you see, this is the case of many working class people.
Yeah.
All across this country who have various maladies. And alcoholism is a problem. And a person who's making... my father was a Teamster. My father's still alive, by the way.
Yeah.
He's a Teamster. And he was making good money. And he had good benefits. But, you know, if you drink a lot, you can't manage your money very well. And you're apt to be evicted. And you're apt to fall behind in the mortgage. And lots of other things are apt to happen to you. And so people in the middle class, you know, fall precariously off the edge quite often, and we were one of those families.
Falling off the edge.
Yeah, exactly.
Your parents fought a lot.
Mm-hmm.
What were their expectations of the kids? Were you expected to enter the professional class like you did? Did they expect that for you? Did they push you to achieve in school, that kind of thing?
I'm the second eldest of 9 children. I'm the only one in my family to go to college. And not only did I go to college, but I went beyond that to the rarefied world of the university and got a PhD in psychology and mathematics of decision making. That's a lot of education for someone who's the only one in his or her family to have gone to college. But my going to college was quite random and quite accidental. And my parents were too busy conducting their own lives, I think. And I mean, God bless them, I understand my parents, and I love my parents. My mother married at 18. She was a country girl from Roanoke, Virginia. My father, similarly, from a rural area, he was 21. They were children. What did they know? You know, and I bear my parents no grudges. But I went to college almost as a bolt out of the blue. It was my senior year in high school. I hadn't been doing much of anything. I hadn't taken the college boards. I was a middling student. I could write well and love Shakespeare, but I wasn't interested in anything else. And it was beginning of spring, my senior year, and I was thinking, well, I'll go work in the shipyard in Chester, Pennsylvania. The shipyard, which is now closed,
mm-hmm.
by the way. And I was hanging out at a local place in Chester, Pennsylvania, and the only black professor from the nearby college was in town doing a survey or something, and he came into our hangout. And he talked with us, just local kids, about politics and whatever else we were doing. And I was with one of my girlfriends there who was going to the University of Pennsylvania. He zeroed in on me. And he said, are you going to go to college? And I said, no. And he said, why not? I said, I'm one of 9 children. I have to get a job and go to work. And he said, you can be better than that. And I said, well, how can I do this? I haven't taken the college boards. It's April. Graduation is just down the road. What do I do? And remember, this was 1969. This is when colleges had felt that initial mission to integrate the schools. And remember, there were 100 cities burning every year between 1964 and 1969. And people felt really fairly confident in doing radical things. The professor, his name was Eugene Sparrow, to whom this book is dedicated, got a piece of paper out of his pocket and wrote down the admission director's name. And he said, call this man and tell him I told you to call. I called. I had a long, hour-long interview in which I sat on my hands and very nervously. And I was accepted to college. without having taken college boards. They arranged for me to take them in the fall. I had to take preparatory math courses in the summer. I didn't need English, but preparatory math courses. And I stumbled at first, but very soon I was near the top of my class. So the thing that happened was a man stepped out of nowhere, like the hand of God, mm-hmm. and in Chester, Pennsylvania, on a bad street corner and said, "You can be better."
Now, if this man had not interceded in an almost godlike way,
right.
you probably would have gotten a job at the shipyard
mm-hmm.
and would not have written a book or become an editorial writer. You would not probably have entered the professional class, so to speak.
Exactly. I've been very fortunate. And one of the things I talk about often, what annoys me as a journalist, mm-hmm. when I have my journalist hat on, is that people will ask the question, "What's the difference between your brother and you?" they'll say. And many people who ask that question have their minds made up. You see, they think it's a matter of constitution, you know, mm-hmm. personal constitution, or they think it's a matter of a sort of basic goodness or Horatio Alger-ness.
Mm-hmm.
And they find it difficult when I explain to them that chance and random events played a very big part in my life. And they play a big part in everyone's life.
When you entered college, do you feel like there was a whole new kind of clothes and kind of behavior and all of this that you were supposed to learn that was different from what you were used to?
Well, in Chester High School, and like most high schools of the period, probably most middle-class black high schools, was kind of a fashion plate school. You know, school was a model show. You know, I wore a lot of sharkskin pants and all that. When I went to college, I felt I needed a change of skin, you know? And it was 1969, so naturally I took up the outfits of the Black Panthers. I had this enormous picture on the front of the New York Times Book Review the other day has a picture of me from 1970 with this big hair, you know, from back then. So I took up the garb of the Black Panthers, leather coats and, like, black hats and dark glasses and tried to make myself as tough as I could. And so that's one of the ways I always survive the new circumstance, by putting on a new garb and camouflaging myself and becoming someone else. Actually, I was remarkably suited to college. Sparrow, the professor who sort of rescued me from the corner, he was exactly right, you know? I sort of zoomed straight up, and I flowered there.
After you went to college at Widener
mm-hmm.
in Chester, Pennsylvania,
mm-hmm.
you went to graduate school where you got your doctorate at the University of Chicago.
Yes.
And you write about how when you got to Chicago, it was the first time you realized that a lot of, like, white people walking down the street would look at you and get really scared.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you react to their reaction to you?
I think having gone to college in my hometown, I spent the first 22 years of my life in Chester, Pennsylvania, where everyone knew me and everyone knew everyone by sight almost in the city, it was a sheltered environment naturally. But in Hyde Park, Chicago, with peculiar racial circumstances, it's a middle-class community surrounded on several sides, three sides by ghetto and the fourth side by lake. And I was walking about in the streets at night, enjoying my new world, the big trees and the Gothic towers, and I suddenly began to notice that people would cross the street or run away sometimes or lock their car doors when I walked by. Initially, I was ashamed. Initially, I thought that there was something about me that was wrong, that I was doing something wrong. And I tried to make myself seem less, you know, fear-provoking. But that didn't work, you know. And then I think at some point, as I say in the book, I don't remember why I changed, but I remember when. When someone tried to walk away from me on the sidewalk, I began to walk directly toward them and confront them. It was eerie and very scary for them. And people who read that today, they think, well, why was this man playing with fear this way? And I say to them, think of yourself as a 22-year-old boy away from home for the first time with no real conception of yourself. And the people who walk by you on the street constitute you as a monster. How do you fight against that? Do you shrink and stay in the house at night? Do you walk away from them? You know, at first I used to whistle and...
You said you used to whistle Vivaldi.
Vivaldi was great because people thought, well, you know, this guy, anybody who knows Vivaldi couldn't be a thug.
Right.
He couldn't be a mugger or a thug. Well, he's got to be a nice guy. I used to whistle classical music or Beatles stuff. And I did all kinds of things to try to de-terrify people's image of me. But at some point, I had just had enough.
Yeah.
And I developed a game I call Scatter the Pigeons. If a couple came toward me, and then they shut up, they closed their mouths and tried to veer away, I'd walk in between them. If people tried to cross the street, I'd probably cross the street to meet them, you know? And I'd laugh in their faces. And this was a way for me of taking back my own sort of identity from them. Now, also understand that cultural ideology is very powerful. And I'm thankful that I encountered that image of myself as a terrifying person at 22 when I was a new PhD student at the University of Chicago, and not at 14 or 15 on South Street in Philadelphia.
What would have been the difference?
Well, who can say? But I can tell you that the image of oneself as frightening and violent is very seductive to young men in America. You know, it's very seductive to find that people are frightened of you at 15.
Why is that seductive?
Because we have a culture that is firmly in place the image of the man as a conquering figure. You know, as Clint Eastwood, as Mr. T, you know, as Billy the Kid. You know, this is who we are constituted. We're constituted this way as men in America. And for a powerless young man in the city with a house full of brothers and sisters and nothing of his own, the notion of oneself as frightening and intimidating is extremely appealing. I mean, everything
it gives you power.
Everything in the culture reinforces it, too.
It's maybe the only power you have.
Exactly. But, you know, I was a PhD student, and I was thinking to myself, well, damn it, these people have made me frightening. I'm going to show them how frightening I can be. And I got over that as a 22, 23-year-old. But for a while there, I had a little run of it. And I'm glad I did it, because I essentially went to people and said, I was saying to them, you know, don't see me as this monster, you know. See me as who I am at heart, just like you.
Brent Staples is the author of the new memoir, Parallel Time. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Brent Staples will be back with us in the second part of our show. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Brent Staples. He's written a new memoir called Parallel Time about coming of age in a black working class family and the larger social and racial forces that shaped his life and the lives of his siblings. His younger brother, Blake, dealt cocaine. He was shot and killed 10 years ago by a former customer. Brent was the first person in his family to go to college. He's been a reporter at the Chicago Sun-Times, an editor at the New York Times Book Review, and now serves on the Times editorial board. Brent says that earlier in his career, he went on job interviews where he was asked what he describes as the, quote, real Negro questions, unquote. I asked him what those questions are and what they're meant to find out.
There are very strong expectations that go along with race. And to go into a newspaper as a black person, which I am, with a resume that says PhD and master's degree from the University of Chicago, and all these other descriptions and fellowship descriptions. I had a Danforth Foundation fellowship, a Ford Foundation fellowship. To go in with something like that, it upset people's expectations based on race. You see, most people didn't expect to see a black person with this kind of background. And typically they wanted me to explain myself. Why are you like this when most of the others are dropouts or sort of working class people? Why are you this way? And ordinarily I accepted that questioning and probing without much contesting. After my brother was killed, I changed on that one. We have in this culture the concept of, quote, the black experience, end quote. I use it always in quotes, because typically in the media and in publishing, it has to do with poverty and suffering and deviance and pathology, okay? The culture has come to view this thing called the black experience through pathological lenses, you know? So for me to come into the Washington Post, which I did shortly after my brother was murdered, with this resume that said PhD, science writer for the Chicago Sun-Times, this upset people's expectations based on race. And one of the interviewers began to probe me, to try to find out whether I was, as I say in the book, a real Negro raised in the ghetto with poverty and despair, or one of those faux Chevy Chase Negroes who'd had, you know, dancing lessons and piano lessons as a child, you see? Because the culture, when it deals with blacks, is biased in favor of pathological experiences.
That's considered to be more authentic.
Exactly. That's, you got it, the authentic Negro experience. So after my brother's murder, that whole line of questioning took on a different tack for me.
Well, what was different about it after your brother's murder?
You see, beforehand, I realized that I was being given a kind of halo for being the good guy and sort of fulfilling the American dream. At the same time, there are many people who took the less charitable line of that. And as I saw it, saying, well, great, you know, you deserve your success because you've worked hard and you're wonderful. And those people who are on drugs and in jail, they deserve what they got, too, because they haven't really followed the sort of Horatio Alger line. And I let that pass for most years. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
But when my brother was murdered, I began to see that there were many people who were using my success as a kind of a cudgel to beat him in a way.
You did good. How come he didn't? It must have been
his
fault.
Exactly. And you see, that line of questioning takes on much more serious, you know, visceral, emotional aspects for me. And so I just stopped playing the game.
How'd you stop?
Afterwards, after my brother's death, I began to just push the interview in ugly directions.
Like what?
For example, say, well, what's your family like? The interviewer would say. And I know what that question meant. You know, why are you the kind of law-abiding, you know, PhD guy, and what are the rest of them like? And I'd made up my mind to rattle the questioner's mind a little bit, instead of just saying, well, they're working-class people, you know, and I'm the only one in my family to go to college, and leaving it at that. I began to introduce my brother into the conversation. I began to introduce his corpse into the conversation. And one interviewer was pushing me and probing for a taste of the ghetto, really. And he wanted to know more about my brothers and sisters, too much about my siblings. You know, the second, third question, I knew what he was looking for. He was looking for the authentic Negro experience. And finally, I leaned in across the desk and I said to him, okay, my brother, like 6 weeks ago, was shot to death. He was a drug dealer. A guy pulled up with a Magnum and blew him to pieces. You know, the inference being, is that black enough for you?
What response did you get?
After I started doing that, needless to say, people didn't like it. And typically none. That would be the end mm-hmm. of the conversation.
Would it be the end of your job possibility, too?
In some cases, yes. So it was self-defeating, but it was a rhetorical line I had to follow, you see? Because I was determined, after my brother's murder, not to any way levy my experience and my success as a kind of way to rationalize his death. I was not playing into that authentic Negro game in the way that interviewers typically wanted me to do. I had enough of that.
If you think that a lot of white people want to know if somebody is like an authentic mm-hmm. black person, you know, if they've had the ghetto experience and everything, where do you think that comes from?
And it's not just white people. It's not just white people. I think culturally in America, the sort of affection for the authentic Negro experience, you know, poverty and pathology and so forth, and anger. Mm-hmm. Don't forget anger. You're mm-hmm. supposed to be really angry if you're really black. That part of it has to do with just sort of the racial ideology as a whole. Black people in this country began as slaves. You know, and they were sort of up from slavery was sort of a slogan, you see. And the culture hasn't yet changed its perception to accommodate the fact that the black middle class today is larger than it has ever been, you see. And the cultural templates are just beginning to shift to accommodate the new experience. Hence we have, you know, still young black boys who won't study because studying is a white thing, even mm-hmm. middle-class young boys. They do crime because crime is the black thing. Being a good guy is the white thing.
My guest is Brent Staples. He's written a new memoir called Parallel Time. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Brent Staples. He's on the editorial board of the New York Times. I want to talk a little bit about what it was like for you when you entered journalism and you started writing for papers.
Mm-hmm.
Did you want to write about specifically African-American issues? Or did you want to cover another beat or a more general beat? And was there any pressure on you one way or another to carry a beat that pertained to race?
I started in daily journalism with the Chicago Sun-Times as a science writer. As an egghead, they figured that was the best thing to do with me, and they were right. I mean, I wrote about the bomb. I broke some of the early stories on AIDS, actually, not the ones that the guys at the Chronicle did a much better job, but I wrote some of the early stories about conflicts over how AIDS money should be used and things of that nature, and competing scientific explanations of AIDS. And I was reviewing often books even about economics and about nuclear war and things of that nature and the ecology. That was good for me because I really, as a journalist, I wanted to stay away from the kind of newsroom ghetto that black reporters sometimes get in.
Why do you want to stay away from that? Some people find a sense of solidarity there and feel like it's really important to have that.
Well, it is important to have that, but professionally as a writer, my training as an intellectual was very broad. It was in philosophy. It was in science. It was in the mathematics of decision-making. I have very broad interests. And as you see, for the New York Times, I sometimes write about race. But for the New York Times, I also write about politics. I also write about Clinton, you know, occasionally even about foreign affairs. So I wanted to avoid being in a situation where I'd be pigeonholed to the race beat, and that would be it. I would, even though I have very strong ideas about race in America, I would smother if that's all I could do. And I felt that from the very beginning in journalism. I did not want to smother. Moreover, in fact, in newspapers, if you end up on the ghetto beat, that's pretty much a terminal career.
You stay there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, why would I, all the time I spent, you know, sharpening intellectual tools, why would I throw them away?
When you started writing for papers, were there any assumptions that you felt either editors or other reporters made, white editors or white reporters, assumptions that they made that something was just kind of normal or typical and the way it is, and that you saw as being more racial than that you saw as being white, and that the assumption of a certain kind of attitude or behavior or whatever was something that excluded you because you're not white?
In terms of, I'm not quite sure.
I don't know, but I know some people feel that way.
Oh, sure, people
when
feel
they go to a paper, so I was just wondering if that's something that you had noticed or not.
Newspapering is a very white business, and it will always be. And my personal view is that print will pass from being. It will be gone without non-white people ever having taken a real significant part in shaping it. It's just going to be that way. So I don't, you know, as a writer and as an, you know, I've been an editor at the New York Times of the Book Review. I've edited daily news in the Metropolitan section, and now I write editorials. I basically sort of follow my interests and just do them, you know?
Your book is being published in February, which is Black History Month. I have noticed that there have been many black writers, particularly first-time book authors,
mm-hmm.
getting published this particular mm-hmm. Black History Month.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really been a bonanza for us in terms of having really interesting black writers on the show. At the same time, I found it really troubling that they all seem to be published. You know what I mean? It's like 1 month. I fear that, like, have the publishers, you know, like, taken all their black books and put them in 1 month?
Black History Month is a ghetto. And as an intellectual with far-reaching interests, as a writer who's written an American book that tells an American story, I resent that. My publisher has done a marvelous job of pushing my book, and the editing is superb and wonderful. I'm out in February for marketing reasons. I mean, because you have to do...
Right, the bookstores have their Black History Month
No, actually, what I'm very pleased about is that if you go to the bookstores around the country, that my book is not limited to those sections. People have been made to understand. For example, they open this book and they read the chapter headings. And they see one chapter, the chapter headings are called Living in Motion. The one chapter is called The Silver Surfer, about a comic book character. The other chapter is called, the biggest chapter in the book is called Mr. Bella's Planet. It's about Saul Bellow's influence on Hyde Park, Chicago. Yes, I mean, I've been able to escape that. Many writers will not, because Black History Month is a ghetto, 1/12 of the year when people and publications pay attention to writing by black writers. And that's really unfortunate. And when I get back, I really fully do intend to write a column in the New York Times saying, you know, an argument for the elimination of Black History Month, because it is a ghetto.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Okay.
Brent Staples is the author of the new memoir, Parallel Time. This is Fresh Air.